Soon after reaching Virginia a few weeks later, Dermer was dead. Ippenau appears to have distrusted Squanto from the start. He, more than anyone, understood the temptations that went with an intimate understanding of a culture that was a wondrous and terrifying mystery to most Native Americans. If the English should ever achieve a foothold in this land, those such as Squanto and himself, who could speak the Englishman's language, would possess a powerful and potentially dangerous advantage. They could claim to know what the English were saying, and no one would know whether or not they were telling the truth. For his part, Ippenau had proven his loyalty to his people by attacking Dermer and his men. But Squanto's true motives were anyone's guess. It wasn't just that Squanto had spent some time in England that set him apart. He also possessed a strong relationship with the Indians' spirit world. The cosmology of the Poconocuts included as many as 38 gods and spirits, most of them linked to various aspects of the physical world, the sun, moon, sea, fire, and a wide range of animals. First and foremost in this pantheon was the god they regarded as their creator, Kiatan, who, as Edward Winslow later wrote, dwelleth above in the heavens, whither all good men go when they die, to see their friends and have their fill of all things. Kiatan was the one who had provided the Indians with their corn and beans, and sachems such as Massasoit called on him for support. On the opposite end of the spectrum was the spirit known as Habamuck, or Chipi. Unlike Kiatan, who was benign and remote, Habamuck was very much a part of this world, an ominous spirit of darkness who appeared at night and in swamps and assumed a variety of disturbing forms, from eels to snakes. The Poconocuts' spiritual leaders or shamans, known as powwows, looked to Habamuck to cure the sick, cast a curse, or see into the future. And as it turned out, in addition to Habamuck and Chipi, there was a third name for the spirit Massasoit's people associated with death, the night, and the bitter northeast wind, Tisquantum, or Squanto for short. By assuming the spirit's name, Squanto was broadcasting his claim to an intimate relationship with an entity that the pilgrims later equated with the devil. Massasoit shared Ippenau's distrust of Squanto, and by the fall of 1620, Squanto had been moved from the vineyard to Poconocuit, where he remained a prisoner. When the Mayflower arrived at Provincetown Harbor in November, it was generally assumed by the Indians that the ship had been sent to avenge the attack on Dermer. In the weeks ahead, the pilgrims would do little to change that assumption. In the meantime, Squanto waited for his chance. Chapter 4. Beaten with their own rod. The Mayflower had arrived at Provincetown Harbor on Saturday, November 11th. Since the next day was a Sunday, the pilgrims remained aboard ship, worshiping God under the direction of Elder Brewster. As Puritans, they believed that the entire Sabbath must be devoted to worship, both a morning and an afternoon meeting along with personal and family prayers throughout the day. Work, and especially play on a Sunday, were forbidden. On Monday, the four battered pieces of the shallop were taken ashore, where the carpenter and his assistants began to put the vessel back together. As the workers hammered and sawed, the passengers enjoyed their first day ashore. After more than 2 months at sea, there was what they termed a great need for washing, and the women found a small freshwater pond near the present site of Provincetown. For generations to come, Monday would be wash day in New England, a tradition that began with the women of the Mayflower. At low tide, amid the barnacles and seaweed, they found abundant supplies of blue mussels, bivalves that grow up to 4 inches in length and attach themselves in clumps to shoreside rocks. Passengers and sailors alike enjoyed the first fresh food any of them had tasted in a very long time, only to fall victim to the vomiting and diarrhea associated with shellfish poisoning. But there was other evidence of nature's bounty. The harbor contained untold numbers of ducks and geese, the greatest store of fowl that ever we saw. But it was the whales that astounded them. Every day we saw whales playing hard by us, they wrote. These were Atlantic right whales, huge docile creatures that feed on plankton and other sea organisms by straining seawater between the large plates of baleen in their mouths. Jones and one of his mates, who had experience hunting whales in Greenland, claimed that if only they'd had some harpoons and lances, they might have taken between 3,000 and 4,000 pounds worth of whale oil and baleen. For the pilgrims, who were expected to provide the merchant adventurers with a regular supply of saleable goods, it was frustrating in the extreme to be surrounded by all this potential wealth and yet have no way of capturing any of it. One day, a whale, apparently enjoying the afternoon sun on her dark, blubbery back, lay on the water's surface within only a few yards of the Mayflower, as if she had been dead. It was just too much of a temptation, as a small crowd looked on. Two muskets were loaded, but when the first was fired, the barrel burst into fragments. Amazingly, no one was injured, and the whale, after issuing a snuff, swam leisurely away. The shallop was proving to be a problem. Instead of days, it was going to be weeks before the boat was completed. Some of the passengers began to insist that they should launch an overland expedition. When the Mayflower first sailed into the harbor, the mouth of a river had been sighted several miles to the southeast. Some of them, probably headed by Captain Miles Standish, advocated that a small party be rowed to shore so that they could investigate this potential settlement site. The risks of such a venture were considerable. So far, they had seen no local inhabitants. But for all they knew, huge numbers of hostile natives might be waiting just a few miles down the cape. The willingness of the persons was liked, Bradford wrote, but the thing itself, in regard of the danger, was rather permitted than approved. Perhaps with an eye to reining in some of his military officers' obvious impatience for action, Carver provided Standish with cautions, directions, and instructions. Standish's party comprised 16 men, including Bradford, Stephen Hopkins, whose experience in Virginia might help them if they should encounter any Indians, and Edward Tilly. Each of them was equipped with a musket, sword, and corselet, a light form of body armor that included a metal breastplate. On Wednesday, November 15th, they were rowed ashore. Provincetown Harbor, as well as much of the bay side of the Lower Cape, is characterized by wide tidal flats. Even a small boat runs aground many yards out, requiring the passengers to wade through the shallows to shore. In November, with the temperature on the verge of freezing, it was a long, cold slog to the beach, especially weighted down with armor and weapons. Standish soon had them marching single file along the shore. He was not a tall man. In the years ahead, he won the sobriquet Captain Shrimp, but his courage and resolve were never questioned. Before leaving for America, the pilgrims had contacted another potential candidate for the position of military leader, the redoubtable Captain John Smith. No one in England knew more about America than Smith. He had been at the founding of Jamestown in 1607. In 1614, he had led a voyage of exploration to what he named New England, creating the most detailed map of the region to date. It had been Smith's associate on that voyage, Thomas Hunt, who had abducted Squanto. When the pilgrims approached him in London, Smith wanted desperately to return to America, particularly to the country of the Massachusetts, which he described as the paradise of those parts. But the pilgrims decided that they wanted no part of him. Smith bitterly related how they had insisted that his books and maps were better cheap to teach them than myself. Smith's fatal flaw, as far as the pilgrims were concerned, was that he knew too much. In the beginning of the settlement, they would have had no choice but to do as he said, and this could be dangerous. Smith possessed a strong personality, and a man of his worldly nature might come to dominate what they intended to be an inherently religious enclave. They would not have any knowledge by any but themselves, Smith wrote, pretending only religion, their governor, and frugality, their council, when indeed it was because they would have no superiors. If the pilgrims perceived Standish as a cheaper and more tractable alternative to Smith, They were now paying the price for their misjudgment. Standish was full of martial pugnacity, but he had no idea where he was leading them. If the pilgrims did possess Smith's map of New England, they failed to make good use of it. Rivers were considered essential to a settlement site, and Smith's map clearly indicated that the nearest available navigable waterway was the Charles River, less than a day's sail to the northwest at present-day Boston. The pilgrims, however, insisted on exploring the entire bay side of Cape Cod, even though there was no evidence on Smith's map of a river of any significance along this more than 50-mile stretch of coastline. As Smith later wrote, much of the suffering that lay ahead for the pilgrims could easily have been avoided if they had seen fit to pay for his services, or, at the very least, consult his map. Such humorists, that is, fanatics, will never believe, he wrote, till they be beaten with their own rod. They had marched just a mile or so down the beach, when up ahead they saw half a dozen people and a dog walking toward them. They initially assumed it was Master Jones and some of the sailors, who they knew were already ashore with the Mayflower Spaniel. But when the people started to run inland for the woods, they realized that these weren't sailors, they were the first native people they had seen. One of the Indians paused to whistle for the dog, and the group disappeared into the trees. They followed at a trot, hoping to make contact. But as soon as the Indians saw that they were being pursued, they made a run for it, setting out with might and main along the shore to the south. Standish and his party did their best to chase them, but it was slow going in the ankle-deep sand, and after several months aboard ship, they were in no shape for a long sprint across a beach. Even though they were quickly left behind, they followed the Indians' footprints in the sand. From the tracks, they could tell that the Indians would bound up each hill and then pause to look back to see whether they were still being pursued. After what the pilgrims judged to be 10 miles of marching, but which was probably closer to 7, they stopped for the night. With 3 sentinels on guard at a time, they gathered around a large fire and tried to get some sleep. The next morning, Standish and his men once again set off in pursuit of the Indians. They followed the tracks past the head of a long tidal creek into a heavily wooded area, which tore our armor in pieces. Finally, around 10 in the morning, they emerged into a deep grassy valley where they saw their first American deer. But it was water they truly needed. The only liquid they had brought with them was a bottle of aqua vitae, a strong liquor, and they were now suffering from violent thirst. They were also hungry, with just a ship's biscuit and some cheese to share among 16 men. At last, at the foot of a small rise of land, they found an upwelling of fresh water, called today Pilgrim Spring. They claimed to have drunk our first New England water with as much delight as ever we drunk drink in all our lives. From a group of lifelong beer and wine drinkers, this was high praise indeed. Once they'd refreshed themselves, they marched to the shoreline where they could see the Mayflower just 4 miles to the northwest across the arc of the bay. They made camp, and that night they built a large fire as part of a prearranged signal to let their friends and loved ones know that all was well. The next morning, they found their first evidence of native agriculture, stubbled fields that had been planted with corn in the last few years. Soon after, they found a small path that led to what appeared to be a gravesite, mounds of sand covered with decayed reed mats. In one of the mounds, they found a bow along with several badly rotted arrows. They were tempted to dig further, but deciding that it would be odious unto the Indians to ransack their sepulchres, they returned the bow and arrows and covered them back up. As they continued south, they came across evidence that they were not the first Europeans to have visited this place. First, they found some sawed planks and an old iron ship's kettle, perhaps from the French shipwreck of 1615. Then, near the river mouth that they'd seen from the Mayflower, which was actually more of a two-pronged saltwater creek and known today as the Pamet River in Truro, they discovered the remnants of what must have been Martin Pring's 17-year-old fort. But it was evidence of a decidedly native sort that soon commanded their attention. On a high shoreside hill, they found an area where the sand had recently been patted smooth. This was clearly different from the grave site they had encountered earlier. As three of them dug, the others gathered around in a defensive ring with their muskets ready. Not far down, they found a basket made of woven reeds filled with approximately 4 bushels of dried Indian corn. So much corn, in fact, that 2 men could barely lift it. Nearby, they found a basket containing corn that was still on the cob, some yellow and some red and others mixed with blue. One of the more remarkable characteristics of Indian corn or maize is that if kept dry, the kernels can be stored indefinitely. In Mexico, storage pits containing perfectly preserved corn have been unearthed that were at least 1,000 years old. The pilgrims paused to discuss what they should do next. They had brought wheat, barley, and peas with them aboard the Mayflower for planting in the spring. Many, if not most, European settlers in a similar situation would have had enough faith in their own supposedly superior technology that they would have had no use for a buried bag of native seed. But the pilgrims were not usual European immigrants. For one thing, they were desperate. Due to the woeful state of their provisions, as well as the lateness of the season, they knew they were in a survival situation from the start. Without a plan, and the inevitable swagger a plan engenders, they were willing to try just about anything if it meant they might survive their first year. As a result, the pilgrims proved to be more receptive to the new ways of the New World than nearly any English settlers before or since. They were also experienced exiles. Their 12 years in Holland had given them a head start in the difficult process of acculturation. Going native, at least to a certain degree, was a necessary, if problematic, part of adapting to life in a strange and foreign land. If their European grains refused to grow in this new environment, their very survival might depend on having planted a significant amount of American corn. They decided they had no choice but to take the corn. The place where they found the buried seed is still called Corn Hill. The decision to steal the corn was not without considerable risks. They were, after all, taking something of obvious value from a people who had done their best so far to avoid them. The pilgrims might have opted to wait until they had the chance to speak with the Indians before they took the corn, but the last thing they possessed was time. They assured themselves that they would compensate the corn's owners as soon as they had the opportunity. They poured as much corn as would fit into a kettle, which they suspended from a staff, and with 2 men shouldering the burden, they started back to the Mayflower. They planned to retrieve the rest of the corn once the shallop had been completed. They also hoped to explore the upper reaches of the 2 creeks. If some earlier European visitors had thought the location suitable for an outpost of some sort, perhaps it might serve their own needs. By dusk, it was raining. After a long, wet night spent within a hastily constructed barricade of tree trunks and branches, they continued on to the north, only to become lost once again in the woods. Deep within a grove of trees, they came across a young sapling that had been bent down to the ground, where a native-made rope encircled some acorns. Stephen Hopkins explained that this was an Indian deer trap similar to the ones he'd seen in Virginia. As they stood examining the ingenious device, William Bradford, who was taking up the rear, stumbled upon the trap. The sapling jerked up, and Bradford was snagged by the leg. Instead of being annoyed, Bradford could only marvel at this very pretty device made with a rope of their own making and having a noose as artificially made as any roper in England can make. Adding the noose to what soon became a collection of specimens and artifacts, they continued on to the harbor, where they found a welcoming party on shore headed by Master Jones and Governor Carver. "And thus," Bradford wrote, "we came both weary and welcome home." It took another few days for the carpenter to finish the shallop, and when it was done on Monday, November 27th, yet another exploring expedition was launched, this time under the direction of Christopher Jones.